Welcome back to another episode of the Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And today I have a special guest, Alyssa Mancow out of California, or LCSW. I don't want to ever disrespect any LCSW. I'm not saying LCSW because that is a hard thing to get. So she agreed to come on this podcast because I share a lot of her posts on Instagram because they are thoughtful and she just breaks things down in such simple terms, and honestly reshare them because they help me out and people do.
Oh, thank you.
But like I share these for my own personal selfish reasons. But but go ahead, you can introduce yourself better than I can introduce you. Go ahead and let the people know about you and where you come from.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be part of this discussion and conversation. My name is Alyssa Leah Mancow. I am a licensed clinical social worker in the state of California. Right now, I run a private practice in Sherman Oaks, California, which is within the Los Angeles County area. And prior to my private practice, I was actually also working at a level 12 placement in the community mental health setting for almost 10 years.
Nice. So,
me, and that's what I do.
Sweet. So, of course, I got to ask you the age-old question. What got you into social work?
You know, gosh, that's a really good question. I'm still trying to figure out how to, like, make my answer concise. But I do remember ever since elementary school, I've always had a passion for helping people. I read a lot of, like, elementary school appropriate books, right, on, like, civil rights leaders and then even like spiritual leaders like Gandhi that just had a mission to like help and serve others. So just that's something I was always into in elementary school. Like I would write my book reports on like certain people that were like in the activist world, but I had no idea it was activism. I just thought like it was helping people. So then in high school, I kind of continued that work by like volunteering a lot with the church that I was part of, canned food drives, going to homeless shelters and things like that. And then I decided I wanted to get my bachelor's degree in sociology because I wanted to understand how the systems outside of us affect our functioning as individual people. Because side note, I was also born in the Philippines and I came to the States when I was 4 years old. And when I was in high school, I started going back home to the Philippines every year or every other year. And I just really did notice the differences in social stratification and inequality in both countries. And I really wanted to just be kind of like a vehicle to be able to bridge communities and resources. Because I saw that the people in the Philippines, they didn't have access to as many resources as the people in the States did. And I kind of just wanted to learn more about that and why that happens. So I got my degree in sociology. Mm-hmm. And then I decided I wanted to advance to social work. I honestly didn't really understand what social work was at the time.
Yeah.
To be honest, I wanted to be a missionary without the religious aspect.
Yeah.
So it was very naive. Like I just want to help whatever that looks like. And so I ended up getting my master's in social work. All of my internships were clinical, and that was something I wasn't expecting, and that's how I ended up becoming a clinical social worker. Yeah. So it's also realizing you can make those changes on micro level institutions.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's my story.
So what did you think social work was before you got into it?
In my mind, and you know, I'm sure that a lot of people do this, I just thought it was like a lot of advocacy and bridging people to resources. I think what I thought it was case management, and that's still social work, but I didn't realize you didn't need a master's degree to do case management. But for me, it was kind of like going into communities and helping people identify what is it that you need and how can I help you get connected to it? How can I help reduce the barriers that can help you get access to resources? Because I notice in a lot of communities, especially in communities of color, there are so many barriers.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to be that bridge.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because before I got into social work, mm-hmm. actually, because I kind of have the same path, mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to be a missionary,
you know? Minus the religious aspect.
Yeah. my first goal was to be like a CPS worker, and that was kind of the only thing I knew about social work was that CPS workers were social workers, you know. So I didn't know that you can be like all this stuff was happening in social work until I got to working inside of a correctional facility. You know, the first one I worked at, and I met the therapist, and he told me, you know, you know, the route to go to therapy or to be a therapist was you could either get an LPC or you could be a social worker, you know. So then once I got the I thought social work was just child protective services and therapy. Like then, you know, and I'm still kind of learning, like, there's, you know, there's more things in social work. And then I got into grad school, and then, you know, my program wasn't a clinical program. It was like a community leadership program, like, you know, organizational leadership. Yeah. So, so then now there's so many things that I'm trying to learn about social work just because, you know, like the therapy role, like I don't want to pigeonhole myself into that. So yeah, I feel like everybody kind of like, there's like stages of like learning about what social work is. And like, once you get like to another level, you learn that there's more, and then you keep learning more and more and more.
Yeah. It feels like we're a jack of all trades.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I don't know, that's one thing, you know, I feel like if you can do social work, you know, you can pretty much kind of put together any kind of resume.
Right, yeah, because I know people who are in private practice. I know people who run organizations. I know people who are in politics.
Yeah.
It's so vast.
Yeah, for real. So you said you worked at a level 12 program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is that? What is that?
So it was a level 12 placement in the community mental health setting. And this is basically where kids who they had already gone to juvenile hall, but they weren't ready yet to go back into the community. They were sent to this level 12 placement for more rehabilitation. And their time there was anywhere between 6 months to 2 years. So it was a lot of, criminal offenders and sex offenders, juveniles.
Okay. It sounds like a lot like Oregon, except for we have five levels. It's BRS, like Behavioral Rehabilitation Services. There's five. Five is like right before you go to, you know, McLaren or, you know, one of our, OIA facilities. Four is like kind of like, you know, like you might need a little treatment, but we can't really have you go home yet. You know, three is like, you know, you get like, you're in a program, but you're in the community and you get home visits. And two, I don't even know what two is, but then
outpatient mental health, probably.
Yeah, probably you're at home, but you know, like you go to outpatient. Yeah. there's those five levels. So how's private practice been going for you? Like, you know, how did you build it up, and what was your, like, you know, your motivation, and, you know, and especially in these tough times, you know, how do you keep just waking up and plugging and chugging away?
Oh gosh, these are really good questions. So how I got started into private practice, actually the community mental health setting that I was, where I worked out for so many years, one of the perks of working there was you were actually allowed to use your own office for private practice for up to 5 hours a week. So that was like a really great perk because you don't have to pay overhead. And that's how I got started. And then I noticed immediately my 5 hours filled up very quickly. And so I started to rent office space elsewhere, kind of in the evenings, or like early mornings. And then once I found like my caseload was growing and growing, I realized like, oh, I could do this full time. Yeah. And we might get into this, but one of the reasons that I had decided to go into private practice full time and leave the community mental health setting, because I never thought I was going to leave community mental health. I really never thought I was going to, and not because I felt like that was the only thing, but I'm so passionate about community mental health.
Yeah.
They really do, like, the community mental health, you know, we really need good quality care there. So one of the reasons that I left was I didn't agree with a lot of the practices that were being done in community mental health and a lot of the barriers to access that, that was happening there in those institutions. So I ended up going into, my private practice full time. And, you know, one of the ways that during these times you ask, like, how do I keep going? And I think it's because this is my purpose. I find a lot of joy in helping people connect with themselves and connect with other people. I think there's a lot of healing that happens in the therapy space. And I think during these times, if people need anything right now, it's therapy. Mm-hmm. It's the support to be able to stabilize their mental health or improve their mental health, because there's a lot going on collectively.
Yeah, that is true.
Did I answer all of the questions? Sorry.
Because private practice, like, to me, like, it's, I see a lot of people that do it full time, you know, and I just I don't know. I'm not really there yet. Cause in Oregon, you know, like, you could do private practice without having the LCSW. You just you just can't bill insurance, you know, but you can do like cash payments and checks, stuff like that.
Do you have to have a supervisor?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, I don't know. I think it's kind of like I think it's like if you have one, good, but if you don't have one, nobody's looking for you to.
Oh, wow.
So I mean, don't take my word on it.
Okay.
You know, like I know you are probably supposed to have a supervisor. Yeah, okay. You know what I'm saying, but I think if you do it, you know, and you keep it like on the low, and nobody like has to like you know charge you for malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think nobody's coming to look for you. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I always you know because I think because there's days where you know there's days where work is tough. You know, it's like man, if I would just have my own space, I could kind of do my own thing and. You know, but I'm just not really there yet, you know. So, but like you said, like it sounded like yours built up pretty quick, you know. So did you ever like second guess it or you kind of was like, all right, I got 20 clients seeing me every week, it's go time.
I second guessed it for a long time. It was in 2016 where I decided to see a few private practice clients at the agency that I worked at. And I was working at my agency full time and another agency part time doing home visits. And then I had my private practice also. And it took me about 3 years before I decided to go into private practice full time because it is a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be honest, you know, when you're in graduate school, even if it is a clinical program, they don't teach you how to be in private practice. They don't teach you how to work for yourself. They don't teach you how to be an entrepreneur. They teach you to go right into community mental health.
Yeah.
So I did second guess it for a really long time.
Yeah. I've actually, you know, when I was in grad school, a lot of my professors told me, you know, just get licensed. Even if you're not going to do, you know, like, the work, just get licensed because you always want to have it. But there were some that were against the LCSW, and I feel like that was kind of like, you know, that's like, yeah, like I get like your personal, you know, beliefs, you know, but mm-hmm. like I feel like, you know, you charged me so much to come to grad school, you should try to, you know, make sure that my career is, you know, like I get the most out of my career, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Because it's expensive to
it is
work, you know, so
it is.
So in private practice, you know, are like you know, just working in general, you know, like how do you gauge, you know, like a success in a case?
I gauge it kind of just based on their presentation coming into every session.
Mm-hmm.
Are they satisfied with their life? Are they finding a sense of purpose, meaning? Are they finding joy and happiness and improvements in their interpersonal relationships? It depends on what they're coming in with. Some people are coming in with because they're experiencing like a lot of conflict internally. They're experiencing a lot of conflict at work. They're experiencing a lot of conflict in their marriage. So the way I find success is how are they now navigating this conflict? Are they shutting down and isolating, or are they communicating? Are they sharing how they feel? Are they thriving? So that's one of the ways that I gauge success in my practice is just kind of looking to see how they're feeling on the inside and seeing if those feelings are also reflecting behaviorally.
Okay. And do you like specialize in any kind of like, you know, couples, youth, older, you know, adults, or is it kind of like whoever gets a referral, you kind of see them all?
I definitely think I've like narrowed down. It's so interesting because when I was in community mental health, 100% of the work I did was with the youth. Obviously, like you work with the family as collateral and you do family therapy sessions, you know, when it's needed, but the youth was always my specialty. And I really never thought I was going to stop working with that population. But once I entered the private practice field, I would probably say that my specialization and the majority of the clients I work with are young adults. So people early 20s to 30s.
Okay.
That's kind of the range.
Yeah. So like, what kind of things do you like usually see like in referrals? Like, is there like, you know, is it state mandated, or is it like, you know, people who have, you know, depression, or people who are trying to like, you know, kick a, you know, like an addiction, or is there like a, you know, like a pattern you see, or is it kind of like, or is it like a wide range?
It's definitely not state mandated. I think that if you're seeing state mandated clients, that might happen maybe on the community mental health level. I think I could be completely wrong, probably because I would assume if it's state mandated, well, maybe I'm just speaking from when I was working community mental health, all of those clients were state mandated because it was covered by Medi-Cal. But none of my clients right now are state mandated. They're all coming into therapy voluntarily. A lot of what I treat and a lot of what people are coming in for is distress in relationships, whether it's for their friendships, their marriages, their coworker relationships. It's a lot of depression, anxiety. And because I am in like the hub of LA, what I do also get are people who are struggling with creativity and people who are struggling with body image. In LA, and I'm sure like probably all of US, right, with Instagram and everything going on, there are these unrealistic standards of what a body should look like. So I really do get a lot of the individuals who are struggling with body image and their relationship with food and things like that.
Yeah, that is interesting, you know, because like I feel like in Oregon, yeah, there's like I've seen like a lot of clients for depression and things like that, like around like poverty and like kind of living like in rural areas and stuff. But but that is a point that, like in LA, you know, where you know you're trying to like you're probably there to you know to be a movie star, or to be a screenwriter, or to be something. And you know, you go to an interview, somebody might say, "Oh, you might be 10 pounds too heavy," like that. You know, and that stuff could probably weigh in on you. You know, then it's nice all the time, so people probably know where, you know, wear different style of clothing than they will wear up here in May and June and things like that. Because in Oregon, it can still be cold in June. You know, so like, so I never really thought about like how, you know, like how that, you know, how different that could be like down there.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're saying, like you deal with a lot of people who come in with body image, like, you know, like I never even thought of that to be something that, you know, that would be something to work through in therapy. I mean, of course, I've thought about it, but I've never seen a case. So you say that, it's like dang, that's real.
Absolutely. And it makes me wonder. I wonder if it's more common in like large metropolitan areas like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Miami, right? Because here in Los Angeles, every corner you turn, there's like a place where you can get Botox or a place where you can like get plastic surgery. You know, it's so prevalent, and especially in certain industries where you're judged off of how you look. It's a really big deal, and people who would come into to LA with like really great self-esteem, you know, it doesn't always work out that way. The industry really ruins it. And you might not even be in the industry. You might just be living in LA, having a regular job, but you see so many messages about how you're supposed to look and present.
Yeah. I remember the first time I like went to LA and like it actually like hung out and seen stuff. Like people were like, you know, the presentation was like, was A+. Everybody's dressed up down here Sunday. You know, like, why are
right.
dressed up? It's so it's just, yeah, in Oregon, yeah, we're not. Like I said, it could be, I mean, you could wear a hoodie all year, honestly. You know?
Right. You know? That's beautiful.
I mean, there's hot days, but it's only hot for like 2 hours, really. So your full private practice, you know, usually, you know, when I talk to, you know, like a lot of my guests, you know, they're a therapist of color. So I ask about, you know, how race and mental health, you know, are one, you know, are connected, you know. So how do you feel like race and mental health are connected? And you have a different perspective because, you know, you're Filipino. So, like, I've only talked to, like, you know, African-Americans about this. So I'm really interested to hear, like, your perspective of how race and mental health are connected.
So that's, like, a really, really big question. So I'm going to just break it down on different levels. I think the ways that race and mental health are connected, there are definitely certain stigmas and stigmatizations about mental health in different communities, especially communities of color. There's a lot of lack of trust when it comes to mental health professionals and communities of color, specific to the Asian communities. And I know that this also applies to other racial and ethnic minorities. We actually exhibit mental health symptoms a lot differently than other people. We have more somatic symptoms like headaches, gut issues, physical tension, things like you go to the doctor for and you want to like a medical diagnosis, right? And the doctor's like, everything's fine. And you're like, no, you got to find something. Because in our communities, there's so much stigma around mental health that we then develop like all of these physical ailments, and then we want like a medical diagnosis for those physical ailments. I've definitely worked with a lot of Filipino clients, and I have definitely seen a lot of physical symptoms based on their mental health presentation. I've worked with clients who had anxiety, but instead of it coming out as like the nervousness or like the rumination, it comes out as ulcers or kidney stones.
Yeah.
right? It's things like that. And then I think also because there's some, a lot of spirituality in communities of color, there's always like this kind of like go-to where it's like, pray about it, pray about it. And I think a lot of, you know, that's generational, you know, parents or grandparents will tell you to just pray about it. And so I think that further creates kind of like a stigma around mental health services. Because it's not really, really an open thing talked about in communities like, oh, you should see a therapist. Also, the way race plays into that is if your families were to tell you you should see a therapist, going to therapy is very expensive.
True.
Right. And we, and, you know, we all know that, those that are, marginalized are communities of color. So when it comes to having your basic needs met, therapy kind of just becomes it feels like a luxury.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not something like you would really want to spend your money on when other things have to get taken care of first.
Yeah. That's a good point, you know, because it's kind of like, you know, like when the money gets tight, you know, the haircuts are the first thing that kind of like gets done less, you know. So I feel like, you know, therapy is looked at as something like this extra, not like a necessity. Because, I mean, at least that's how it's painted, like, you know, like how I was growing up. It was like something that, you know, rich people do.
You know? Yeah.
Rich white people don't do therapy. We don't do therapy, you know, like you kind of just take life how it comes and, you know, and it's, that's just how it is. You know, I have a lot of youth. Part of my goal, you know, because I work with a lot of young African-American males, you know, some of, you know, very violent offenders, you know, but, and part of like, one of my personal goals is to try to get them more comfortable with talking about just how they feel, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I had a few kids in my office this weekend talking about, like, you know, like, how they look at death, you know, and one youth was kind of saying, like, you know, death is death. I don't really, it doesn't matter if I die now, if I die in 50 years, we all gonna die, so, and, you know, and I, you know, and of course, I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to dive in at that moment, because I don't want to, like, push them away, but, you know, I kind of just curious to know, like, well, why, you know, like, how did you come to that determination, like, you know, because, you know, because you can, I mean, yeah, true, we all have a day to die, but it's like, you know, like nobody really wants to run, you know, to the grave. So, but that's just kind of the stuff. Because in Portland, like, you know, East Portland is like a very rough part of town, you know, like it's just a lot of drugs out there, a lot of poverty out there, a lot of gangs out there, you know, and a lot of my kids that I work with come from that part of town, you know, and it's different because I grew up in Portland, but when I grew up in Portland, it was pre like before, like, you know, we pushed people out, you know, gentrification, you know, so like, you know, so my part of Portland was a little different, you know, like it was still that stuff going on, you know, but it wasn't like as intense. And now since they push everybody out east, it's like super like concentrated, and you got a whole bunch of communities of people out there who are just surviving. So like I feel like he has a, you know, this kid has a survivor's mentality, you know, and I want to work with him to kind of, you know, like to figure out, you know, to pinpoint, you know, why his mentality is the way it is.
You know? Yeah. And to your point, that's a big example of how race affects mental health in certain communities of color, especially racial and ethnic communities. Trauma is very much normalized.
Yeah.
Like, commonly what I hear and have heard working also in the justice system was it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
It is what it is. And that is a big normalization of trauma. That's a big normalization of systemic oppression and all of those things. It's like, oh, well, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. Right. There's like a, so I do see like certain communities when a traumatic thing happens, instead of thinking like, oh, this is terrible, I need to talk about it. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. You know,
oh, okay. Yeah, well, another one bites the dust.
Yeah. Like, oh, there's another thing that, you know, this is another obstacle to, you know, to get over.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Right, you know, because when you're in it, it's like, you know, you never stop and say, like, oh, man, this is different, you know, especially when you're in nothing else.
Yeah. You never stop to think this is not okay.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, like putting all of these, you know, these people in jails, I feel like, yeah, the jails have a purpose of like, you know, rehabilitation, but putting everybody with the same kind of mindset in the same kind of place with the same kind of trauma, you know, like it's really hard because like a person I work, if a person tries to stand out, try to be different, try to change, you know, the way they think and, you know,
you can't. You'll get me in front of.
Do it. It's like, you know, they get questioned and
yeah.
I survive in there too. You know, like I tell a lot of my staff, it's like, you know, like one thing, like we seem to not really put into context is like these youth live here. They have to live here, you know? So like them getting into a fight and like losing their level is way easier to get your level back than to get respect back. You know, so like people just like, you know, scratch their head. Oh, this kid was doing so good. Why would he do such a thing? It's like, well, I mean, in 90 days, he'll do good again. He'll get his level back. But if he, you know, if he did something out there that wasn't looked upon as, you know, like ethics in their world.
Yeah, there are too many codes.
Yeah.
There are too many codes that they have to survive through. Yeah.
So, but in reality, it doesn't really change from inside there to their life and on the outs. It's kind of, it might look similar, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just tough, you know, like it's tough and, you know.
And it's true. They live there, but they also have to go home, right? So everything you're teaching them, it's hard to use those skills when your life is in danger.
Yeah.
When your life is really in danger.
You know.
So they're living in those two worlds.
Yes. You know, and it's in you know, so like your mental health might not be, you know, the forefront of it, you know, but I'm just trying to get, you know, I'm sure like, you know, we're trying to get people to stop and think for, you know, 10 seconds, you know, just stop and think before be so reactive, you know, so, your Instagram account, which I'm a follower of and I love it.
Thank you.
It seems like you put like a lot of like, you know, time into the graphics, you know, like, you know, what kind of inspires those posts, you know, like they are helpful. I love them, you know, but to a person like me, like I feel like, you know, like I don't really like have like the vocabulary, you know, or this to kind of like, you know, the wherewithal to like, you know, put those posts together. So I'm always inspired when I see people who do it, you know. So like, how do you like, you know, get the ideas to, you know, make those posts?
I felt that way before too, that I felt like I didn't have the vocabulary, even the creativity to do it. If you ever scroll all the way down to the bottom of my feed, it didn't always look the way it did. It was like a lot of like reposting and resharing. And then so it kind of like came a time I was like, let me just try to make one of my own. And then I was doing it like a little bit more and more. But what inspires me to create my posts are my conversations with my clients. Right. If they say something, I'm like, oh, that would be a great, like, if they're going through this, I know a lot of other people are going through this. Let me create a post about it. For me, it's so important to normalize a lot of what people are going through because people are not alone. So I'm inspired by my conversations with my, by my clients. I'm inspired by conversations with my friends. Sometimes if my friends are going through something, I'm like, let me make a post about that. Like send a little subliminal message. No, I if I'm watching like a TV show or a documentary, I'm like, oh, that's a good topic. Let me make a post on it. So or if I'm listening to a TED talk, so I'm finding inspiration through the things in my environment. And I even pull from my own life too, you know, it's really important to normalize the human experience and everything that we go through. And sometimes it's hard to come up with posts. You know, I want to be very honest. I could watch all the TED Talks in the world and like have as many sessions as I want. Sometimes, you know, that creativity just gets tapped out, but that's okay. It's part of it. I really do pull a lot from my professional and personal life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you like have like a lot of students that like always hit you up like, hey, you know, you mind helping me out with certain things? And I'm trying to be a social worker and how do I start that process? And things like that.
Yeah. When my page didn't have as many followers, and I feel terrible saying this, I would get a lot of those messages and I would reply to all of them, but kind of like to the level where it's at, I still get them, but I don't read my direct messages anymore. Because it was getting really overwhelming to help people. I actually got an email last week from somebody from another state, I think, asking if I could be their mentor. And as much as I would like to help people, one of the things that we preach about in social work is self-care and boundaries.
Yeah.
So I really had to find that in an effort to protect my personal and digital space. I had to kind of set those limits into how many people I can help or like whatever. But yeah, I do get those questions a lot, and it's nice. It's nice to see that people want to go into this field, because it's not a glamorous field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's definitely not. You know, like I tell a lot of people, like, you know, there's a lot of things I could be doing besides doing what I'm doing. You know, but like, well, you know, but I feel like, you know, just like you said, you know, what I'm saying earlier, like it was a calling.
Yeah. You know?
Actually, and that's why, like, I went to the unit that I work for now, because before I was on, like, a mental health unit, like a specifically mental health unit. And in those units, I think we have, like, three of them, like, you know, where I work at, there's three, like, specific mental health units. And those units are, like, new, they're cushy, you know, you have your own office as a therapist, you know, ours is QMHP, you know, like, I feel like people respect the QMHP role. Now we're, you know, like up in a gym pop unit where you're just like kind of like another staff, and it's not as respected, you know what I'm saying, or it's not as like utilized up there. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of African American young males up there, and when they asked me to go up there, I was like, you know, this unit had a bad reputation, but I feel like, you know, I've always asked to kind of work in the community that I serve, or, you know, that I come from. You know, and a lot of these youth come from Portland. Like, I came from Portland with the same kind of background, you know, foster care, parents, you know, down and out, you know, living in poverty. So mm-hmm. It was like, I got to, you know, I just have to do it, you know. So, mm-hmm. But you're right, it's not a glamorous field, but it does feel good to, it doesn't mean, you know, and not to sound like, you know, like I'm a savior or stuff, but it just feels kind of good to make those connections.
It does. It's rewarding.
Mm-hmm. You know, definitely. You mentioned self-care. You know, what kind of things do you do for self-care? Like, how is your self-care practices happening in this, you know, this COVID-19 craze?
Pre-pandemic, my self-care was going to the gym. Mm-hmm. I was going to the gym and then going to this the spa right after, because my gym and my spa right next to each other. It was in going out to eat, so that's pre-pandemic. Currently, my self-care is honestly unplugging, watching TV, mm-hmm. You know, going for walks when I can. I don't want to say reading books, because I'm not big on reading. Yeah. So, and it's just been like connecting with my friends. You know, I think, you know, being in private practice and being on Zoom calls all day long, my self-care is not going on Zoom calls with my friends. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
So it's probably like just texting them and like having some like quick phone calls here and there, just to be able to have like a semblance of human connection. So that's been my self-care lately. I've just been trying to keep it really, really simple and making sure I get enough sleep.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like, do you feel like you struggle with, like, you know, cause you're working, like, because I feel like when you kind of put like work online, mm-hmm. you work 24/7, you know. Mm-hmm. But do you find like a struggle with like trying to like turn off work? Because I mean, like I do telehealth with two clients, and they're like little kids. So I have one kid that will like call me, like, you know, I was like, hey, you know, so I try to keep it like a boundary, like, hey, you know, let's call at 12:00, and then like I'll miss the call, and then they call me back at 3:00. It's like, hey, man, like, you know, and I want to say like, hey, our time is at 12 and 3:00, and I'm moved on to something else, but I don't. But you know, with someone who has like a full caseload like you, you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you like find the time to, you know, set those boundaries and set that, you know, like, for it's like, hey, 5:00. I know we can talk on the phone whenever, but I need you to call me before 4:00, because that's just kind of what we need to do. You know, so how mm-hmm. do you, you know, the kind of or how do you deal with, you know, trying to balance the, you know, the that kind of thing that you know, come with doing like telehealth?
It's so hard. It's so hard to have those boundaries, especially in the world we live in, the digital age, where everything is kind of like feels very instant. Like if somebody calls you, you feel like you got to call them back right away. If somebody emails you, you feel like you got to email them back right away. And I'm constantly working at it. Like psychologically, I've created times. This is when I'm working. This is when I'm not. Sometimes on the weekends, I'll delete my email app, my work email. I'll delete the app, because if I have it on my phone, I'll just check it. I'll just be checking it. And then I'll see like an email from somebody like, oh, I have to respond right away, like on a Saturday. And it's like, yep. No, I don't. Like if I were working for an agency, I would not have access to my email because I would have to see it when I get to the office. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of creating like those psychological barriers, right? Like taking my email off of my phone. And then you know, in my informed consent, I do let clients know, like, if they call me, I have up to 48 hours to respond. So that kind of relieves me of any kind of like that instantaneous like guilt, like I have to do something right now. Yeah. Because we're also trained that way too in social work to be like effective and like quick with our interventions. And we forget that we need to also have those boundaries and we don't have to respond right away.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. And I definitely feel like an urgent need to respond. Mm-hmm. Just because like I've been in so much like crisis work.
Mm-hmm.
Working inside of a facility, like things, crisis, like triage is kind of stuff just happens. So like you want to fix things, mm-hmm. but it wasn't until I got into like doing like, you know, private practice, you know, mm-hmm. working with contractors that I learned, like, you know, you don't have to fix the problem every session, you know,
right.
Or like try to come into it like, okay, this is, you're feeling depression. Well, let's try to knock that out and, yeah. You know, right now. So, I mean, that's something that I went through, just kind of like, you know, knowing that you don't, like, it's not on you to, you know, to fix these things right now, you know. So, just kind of slow down, you know, go with the client's pace, not the professional. Yeah. I said that before, professional pace, you know, because we don't always know everything.
Yeah. I was trained in DBT, and they had this saying called, don't fragilize your patients, don't fragilize your clients, right? And I think oftentimes as therapists or social workers, we have a tendency to feel like, oh, they can't do it, or, oh, I have to help, right? We're fragilizing them. We're kind of creating this narrative like they can't do it. And so I've like internalized, like, don't fragilize them. Like they're in crisis now, but they can handle it. Because they've been in crises before they met me, and they've gotten through it.
Yeah.
So, like they can do it.
Yeah. And then I've heard that phrase before, you know, and just talking to different social workers, you know, and it's kind of humbling because some will tell you that, you know, it's your, you know, well, like with insurance, like, you know, I mean, just, you know, when they try to like, you know, talk to you about like, you know, your cases, you know, like they put it on you, like it's your responsibility for these person to get better.
But what are you doing? Yeah.
But I'm them, you know, and it's and I feel like that should be the focus. It's like, yeah, you do the treatment plans and all that stuff, but it's still, you know, like it still should be like promoted as, you know, it's on you, you know what I'm saying, to, you know, to make it better. And you can make it better. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have to live this way. You know, you've been through tough things before. So let's just remember how we got through them, and, you know, let's get through them again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Any kind of thing you want to tell to the people that are listening, you know, any kind of wisdom you want to share about, you know, your things you got going on, you know, your social work, ideologies, anything? This is kind of like a free form right now. Go ahead.
Okay. If there's anybody listening and they're social workers and they're interested in the private practice field, I really want to encourage people to enter it. Something that I'm noticing as a therapist of color in the private practice world is there aren't enough of us. There isn't enough representation in the private practice world. I think we're all concentrated in community mental health, and I get it and it makes sense, but there are also people of color that want a therapist in private practice that's, you know, also a person of color. Like I've had huge wait lists of people who have sought me out because I am a woman of color, and they wanted a therapist who's a woman of color. There's not enough of us. And I think that there is a sense of like, we talk about like race and mental health, right? There's a sense of like, when you go into social work, glorification of poverty, right? Like, oh, you're not going into this or this to make money. I've like heard this in another podcast, by John Clark, like you're not going into this to make money. And there's a lot of shame if you do make money, right? Like if you're going into this field for money, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. But I think that plays into like race also, right? It's like, I went to USC and there were a lot of people of color in my program. And most of us, people of color, went straight to community mental health when we graduated because that's what we were groomed into thinking we were supposed to do and all we can do. And a lot of my counterparts who were white went straight into private practice.
Oh,
right. Okay. And so I really did see that kind of like, just that whatever it's called there, right? You see how race even plays into your dreams and your goals. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm just encouraging people of color, if you ever want to go into private practice, I there's room for all of us. Our communities need it. I don't think that you have to kind of succumb to the idea that, you know, you came into this field and you're not supposed to make money. I think you can do both. Mm-hmm. I just want to encourage more people of color to enter the private practice world, whether it's full-time or part-time, because our communities need us.
Yeah.
They really do. There's something in terms of our own cultural competency that we'll understand that maybe another therapist who's not a person of color won't understand.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I was just talking about, I had an experience at work where I got micro assaulted. By my, mm-hmm. not my manager, but a manager on the unit that I work for, you know, like, you know, the whole clinical team was at different management. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, like, he said some stuff that was out of pocket. But it wasn't, like, to the point where it was, like, clearly out of pocket. Like, if you weren't, like, a person of color, you'd probably be like, well, why are you tripping? Like, yeah, he was kind of right. You should be doing what he asked you to do. You know, but at the same time, it's like there's no like management or there's no clinical management that looks like me, mm-hmm. that that I would feel comfortable going to, because I feel mm-hmm. like they wouldn't. They'd be like, you know, or they might, you know, show that they care, but I feel like I didn't want to risk them saying something that would make me even more upset. So I just kind of took it, tucked it, you know, told who my friends, you know, vented about it. But but as far as like having like some kind of traction of like some kind of like record about it, like who was I going to tell that, you know? So like you're right. Like I feel like we need to kind of we need to be in more spaces. You know, we need to occupy more spaces that you know that we already currently occupy, because people you know, they need to know. You know, they
we deserve
know.
It.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and you don't need like, and I feel like. You don't need to be questioned like, well, are you sure that's racism? You know?
It's insane. I had a post on that like a long time ago, a few months ago, on like racial microaggressions. And that actually came from my own personal experience being a therapist of color. I go to conferences, and a lot of these conferences, they're majority white people. And I'm probably like, let's say if there's like 1,000 people attending the conference, I'm one of 25 people of color.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if that, and the microaggressions that you experience as a person of color, I know that my microaggressions as like an Asian woman are far different than probably the microaggressions that an African-American person would face, but, you know, but like the microaggressions are insane. You know, people would look at me at the conference and they would think that I'm part of the staff. Like they would ask if I can get water or just like things like that. I'm like, oh my gosh, I too am here as a person.
Yeah, here to learn just like you.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, hey, ma'am, do you know where my hotel, like where my room is? It's like, no. Like, these are real things that are happening.
True.
Right? Or we'll go into breakout sessions and, you know, where it's like 10 people and like a leader there. And then they'll always ask me like, where are you from? And I'm like, you're not going to ask this person where they're from?
Yeah.
All of these things that are very gaslighting. And you're just like, this is racism. This is microaggression. True. But yeah. But there's nobody else there for me to like look at and share it with, right?
Yeah, you gotta sit in it. You know, mm-hmm. But yeah, I do appreciate you speaking that we need, you know, more people in private practice. You know, I'll get there one day.
Promise. Yes. Oh gosh. Please. That we're connected. Please reach out to me. I know we're in different states, so the laws are different. But if you need any help, reach out.
Oh yeah, I definitely will. But like your like kind of social observation of the white clinicians went straight to private practice. There was no judgment. It's, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like you're like, we know why we here, you know. But then mm-hmm. like the person of color was like, well, you're supposed to, you know, want to, you know, like supposed to want to give back. And I remember there was a person I interviewed on my podcast like last year. She's kind of saying the same thing, like, you know, like we shouldn't be ashamed to want to make money. But yeah. Then there's somebody who's going to push back and say like, well, you know, like, you know, the people of color don't really have a lot of money to, you know, to spin, and you know like we get that, but at the same time it's like, you know, we shouldn't be playing into this poverty lane.
I want to challenge that, and I know like I really want to challenge that thought, because this is one of the reasons I really love community mental health. I'm trained in EMDR, which is the eye movements, and it's an expensive thing to get trained in, right? So I I put myself through that training because I was also in private practice and at the level 12 placement. So my private practice, these are people who can afford like the self-pay rate, you know, and I was doing EMDR with them. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing such great results. Then I go to work with youth who are severely traumatized by their communities. And I'm starting to do EMDR with them. And I'm like, and it's helping. Yeah. And then I have people from the top saying, you need to stop doing that because Medi-Cal's not covering it. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is ridiculous. So then now the people who can get the services are the people who can afford it. And the cycle continues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. So this is what I want to encourage people who feel like kind of guilty about making money. The more money, and I hate to make it about money because it should never be about money. I want people to know that. But the more financially stable you are, the more pro bono work you can do. Mm. So you're still helping people. So in my practice, I'm still doing pro bono work. Yeah. And I'm actually doing this, you know, for the communities of color who can't afford therapy or who can't get into community mental health because the wait lists are so long.
Yeah.
You know, so you can actually do both.
Yeah.
You can do both.
That's how I've always been my thing too. It's like, you know, if I can, you know, I can always, you know, figure out ways to, you know, to give back, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't have to live in that lane, you know.
You don't, you can live in both lanes.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate you for joining me today. You know, this fine day. Yeah, you know, I continue to do what you do. I love watching, you know, everybody move in social work. I really, you know, I really do love social work. I know it sounds like cliche, but it's like, I love every aspect of it, especially since I've been doing this. I've been just learning more things, you know. I've learned a lot more things, you know what I'm saying, than I would have just learned if I just had a job and just sat in the office all day and kind of stayed in my own little, you know. So stepping out of my comfort zone and interview people and reach out to people, because it's not always the most comforting thing to do, but if I want to, you know, this is something I want to do, and I've learned so much, and I appreciate you for sharing your knowledge with everybody who listens and things like that, and hopefully, you know, they'll reach out to you and try to, you know, and you can share more with everyone.
I'd be so happy to, and I'm really grateful, you know, that you had me on here. I listened to a couple of your episodes, and I love that you interview social workers. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we have the best stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. We do.
You know. All right. Well, thank you again. And I will be in contact.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.